The addition of India and the Philippines there is a little bit surprising, but of course what we're talking about is more numerous attacks but lower death toll.
Terrorism remains a concern in Asia despite a decline. It's Friday, July 21st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, revising Japan's constitution is in question. We hear from a U.S. congressman on Liu Xiaobo and China relations. Asia's strong note on the U.S. piano market. New approaches to sleep and eating disorders. It all starts now on VOA Asia. The United States said the number of terrorist attacks and deaths they have caused fell in 2016 for the second year in a row as nations cooperate in areas such as information sharing, strengthening security measures, and boosting efforts to counter radicalization and recruitment. According to the University of Maryland's National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, terror attacks fell 9% last year to just over 11,000, while fatalities declined 13% to just over 25,600. This was largely due to a drop in incidents in Afghanistan, Syria, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Yemen. While attacks occurred in more than 100 countries, they were mostly confined to five nations: Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and the Philippines. 75% of fatalities occurred in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Nigeria, and Pakistan. The State Department's acting coordinator for counterterrorism, Justin Serbrell, told reporters the Sunni insurgency Islamic State remained the deadliest jihadist group, while it also lost considerable territory in 2016.
Iraqi security forces, supported by the coalition, delivered a series of defeats on ISIS through 2016, beginning with the liberation of Ramadi in February, the recapture of Fallujah in June, and the seizure of Qayyarah Air Base in northern Iraq in July, and finally the launch of the broad offensive in Nineveh in October that led to Iraqi security force penetration deep into eastern Mosul by the end of the year. In Syria, the border between Syria and Turkey was fully cleared of ISIS presence in 2016. Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by coalition efforts, liberated a number of cities and towns used by ISIS as transit and facilitation hubs for foreign terrorist fighters and ISIS external plotting efforts, including Manbij and Jarablus. These operations set the stage for the operation to isolate and liberate Raqqa, which, as you know, is currently underway.
And the United States still considers Iran to be the chief state sponsor of terrorism. Deakin University terrorism expert Greg Barton tells VOA's Victor Beatty part of the decline in attacks is due to setbacks suffered by Boko Haram in Nigeria. But Barton says Islamic State remains a formidable threat.
Well, it's still the number one threat. Having said that, Al-Qaeda, which is 30 years old now, is stronger today than it's ever been, and its various affiliates are more robust and more active than we'd like to imagine. But Islamic State seems set to be a threat for years to come if it manages this transition out of holding territory to being an insurgent force. If there was a breakthrough in politics in Iraq particularly, but also in Syria, we can be optimistic, but I don't think anyone's really expecting the sort of breakthrough that's required to seriously damage this movement from rebuilding itself.
Well, of course, we've had some very high-profile attacks in Europe. More than 100 countries experienced terrorist attacks, but most of them, according to this report, occurred in just five countries: Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and the Philippines.
The addition of India and the Philippines there is a little bit surprising, but of course what we're talking about is more numerous attacks but lower death toll. As a different set of five countries, some overlap, but Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Nigeria last year, as they have been for some years now, accounted for 75% or thereabouts of terrorist deaths. So the more serious attacks are still occurring in those five countries. And it's those five countries that have a chronic breakdown of good governance and are open to a infestation of groups like Boko Haram or Islamic State, and consequently much larger scale attacks and much larger scale death tolls.
Well, Greg, 2 years of declines, what is your sense? Will we see a reversal and perhaps an uptick in 2017?
I don't know about in 2017. The hope is that the decline will continue, but even if it does, it's still of a modest dimension. We're not looking at a long-term, well, at least it's too early yet to be talking about long-term declines. It's entirely possible we'll see a fluctuation over the coming years that move up and down a little bit. A lot will depend upon these five countries where 75% of the terror deaths occur, so Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. We've seen improvement in Nigeria. That's very good. That's where most of the clients have come. We really have to hope for improvements in Iraq and Syria and work towards that. And the long-running problems in Afghanistan connected with issues in Pakistan need to be addressed. Unfortunately, at this stage, Afghanistan's trending in a bad direction, and there's reasons to be concerned about resurgence of problems in Iraq and Syria. So it's much too early to be optimistic, but any decline is a good thing.
And Greg Barton said there's also been an uptick in right-wing extremism in North America and Europe, with such attacks rising at about the same rate as those carried out by jihadist groups. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Leader of Thailand's Red Shirts movement jailed for defamation. Duterte flies to besieged city, warns of other attacks. India's foreign minister says China and India should withdraw troops from Doklam Plateau. Amid VPN crackdown, China eyes upgrades to Great Firewall. China unveils plan to become a world leader in artificial intelligence by 2025. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's falling approval ratings and his party's recent defeat in the local Tokyo metropolitan election puts at risk his long-standing goal to revise the country's pacifist constitution, even if his hold on power remains intact for now. Regional security analyst Grant Newsham with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo.
I don't know that it's dead, but it's a lot less likely than it was just a few weeks ago.
Until recently, Abe, who has been in office since 2012, had enjoyed strong popular support, mostly for his pro-business economic reforms to stimulate the long stagnant economy. But the Japanese leader's popularity has recently plummeted to 36% in one national poll, amid allegations he helped a friend secure free land and approvals to establish a veterinary college, and that his wife made secret donations to an ultra-nationalist kindergarten accused of promoting bigotry against Chinese and Koreans. The prime minister has denied these charges, but Koichi Nakano, a political science professor with Sophia University in Tokyo, says the perception of cronyism and corruption has seriously damaged his standing with the public.
The number one reason why they don't approve of Mr. Abe anymore is because people don't find him trustworthy.
The Japanese public remains divided over Abe's proposal to modify Article 9 of the post-World War II Constitution, prohibiting Japan from going to war to settle international disputes involving the state. Abe's proposal would legitimize the country's self-defense forces while continuing to renounce the right to wage war. A constitutional change requires a nationwide referendum voting in favor, which Grant Newsham says, given Abe's decline in the polls, now seems unlikely.
I don't think that his chances of success are particularly great at the moment, and he would be squandering some political capital if he were to make that his prime objective. And I think that would be a mistake, in my opinion.
The Liberal Opposition Democratic Party has not been able to make any major political gains despite Abe's alleged scandals, his controversial support for a more proactive military, and for nuclear power following the 2011 Fukushima nuclear meltdown. Abe had been projected to win a third three-year term as LDP leader and prime minister, but the likelihood of that is no longer certain. We thank Brian Padden in Seoul for contributing to this story. Happening now in Asia, Qatar's foreign minister is visiting Beijing a day after his Chinese counterpart told a top official from the United Arab Emirates that China hoped the rift between the Gulf countries could be repaired. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We know you have many choices, and we're glad that you've spent part of your day with us on VOA Asia. The recent death of Chinese Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo has led human rights groups to push for the release of his detained wife, Liu Xia. U.S. Congressman Chris Smith, a ranking member on the Committee of Foreign Affairs, agrees. We share an excerpt from his recent comments during an interview with VOA Mandarin reporter Peggy Chang.
Liu Xiaobo's death sentence and his untimely death should be the rallying call to all of us to say enough is enough. Human rights matter. They matter to us. They're not just for Americans or certain Europeans or whoever it might be, or Latin Americans or Africans. It's for everybody, including the Chinese people. And we saw at Tiananmen Square that the thirst and the drive for freedom was as strong as anywhere else on earth, and maybe even stronger because so many people took such risks and then paid such a price for espousing fundamental human rights, including Liu Xiaobo, who saved a number of people and got a prison sentence for that too. So we really have to stop walking on eggshells and being all worried about what Beijing's going to think. They have isolated themselves, and if they really want to be the global player and have respect, if you can't respect your own people, how can you command respect from people in other countries, leaders especially? Respect the person who is at the lowest echelon of the economic ladder, because in God's eyes, frankly, they're as equal as you are. And that's, again, what comes from my faith, that we're all equal as human beings, men, women, regardless of ethnicity. And it's about time we promoted that in China consistently, comprehensively, because it has not been. Even when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, the country itself that issued it was under pressure from the Chinese government. I remember it well. I was in Oslo. I led the effort here in the Congress to have him so named, Nobel Peace Prize recipient. We also had Gao Zhejiang and Chen Guangzhan on that list as well, but we wanted all three. But they did give it to this great man, Liu Xiaobo. But all of a sudden, they put pressure on countries to say, oh, you want that deal, that economic... And they do it with African countries who get their economic support. It's always with a price. People have to say, fine, I'll take your money if and only if human rights are respected and we move in that direction.
U.S. Congressman Chris Smith speaking with VOA Mandarin reporter Peggy Chang. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the Transnational Justice Working Group in Seoul, says the North Korean government uses school grounds and markets to carry out public executions for petty crimes. Several North Korean refugees witnessed the regime's firing squad executing criminals in public areas to attract large crowds and instill fear. Follow the day's big stories at VOA 60 and on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. Like much of the U.S. auto industry, America's piano manufacturers have been hit hard by imports from Asia, as well as by the growing popularity of electronic keyboards. There were 160 piano makers in the United States a century ago. There are only four major producers today. And Tom Bonse reports dealers selling the instruments have had to change their tune to stay in the money.
A dramatic illustration of the economics of pianos can be found in Dean Petrick's workshop and piano sheds. Petrick is a longtime piano tuner based on Whidbey Island, Washington.
Now, this is a piano I just got yesterday. It hasn't been tuned, of course.
So many upright pianos of all ages and conditions are packed in so tight in multiple sheds, Petrick has trouble counting them all.
There's a white piano. There's one that's baby blue with lambs over there. There's a green one with gold trim on it.
Eventually, he estimates he has about 82 pianos stored on his rural property. The prior owners gave them to Petrick for free just to get rid of them and then paid him to haul the instruments away.
As the technology for electronic instruments and keyboards has improved, people have switched because you don't have to tune an electric keyboard. You can carry it with you. It's lightweight. It can make any sound you want.
2 years ago, Petrick's accumulation of cast-off pianos topped out at over 200. Now he's under 100 after giveaways, restorations, or dismantling and recycling. A chance encounter with a small international relief charity led to another relief valve.
I went in there and I talked to him, and I said, well, what about pianos? They said, well, we never thought of that. We don't take pianos. But they called me 2 weeks later and said, you know what? My husband knows somebody at the University of Cambodia, and they have no pianos there, so we would like some.
Petrick donated 10 for shipment to Cambodia last year. Petrick also culled 20 pianos that just shipped to Vietnam to benefit needy schools there. He strikes a hopeful note about his industry's future because of the upturn in the economy, but that might not be enough.
Well, we sold it, so it's going to go out tomorrow morning.
Kurt Clinton is the fourth generation of his family to run Clinton's Music House, and he says maybe the last. The piano dealership was founded in 1898 in Tacoma, Washington. Clinton recalls organs were selling like crazy, along with new pianos, when he took over in 1978, and he had 9 competitors. Now it's just him and a couple of professional tuners who sell pianos on the side.
And as that evolved over the years, and more keyboards started coming out, that business kind of shrunk. And as that business shrunk and the mall businesses shrunk, you know, everybody started moving out of the malls, we needed to find something else.
Clinton says refurbishing and reselling good used pianos is now the major part of his business.
So you always have to have that feeler out there looking for that used piano that some family's done with. Something that's decent that we can pick up and make into a good piano again.
Portland Piano Company is surviving by moving out of downtown this summer to a cheaper warehouse district by the airport and by investing in online marketing. Company manager Brenda Kell says she never would have thought that selling pianos over the internet would work, but that's what's happening. Another interesting trend, she notes, is how families who immigrated to the U.S. from East Asia and India represent an increasing share of her customer base. If it weren't for them, I don't know what we would do, Kell says. And she's not alone in observing a high value placed on musical proficiency among Asian immigrant populations in the U.S. That emphasis is reflected in the number of Asian Americans in prestigious music competitions, including Daniel Hsu from San Francisco, who captured the bronze medal in this year's Van Cliburn International Competition. The downward trend in new piano sales tends to obscure the continued interest in playing the piano. That, according to the industry journal Music Trades, music publishers, for their part, report continued strength in piano method book sales. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
Developing at this hour in Asia, at least one Chinese telecom carrier has begun implementing Beijing's directive to curb the use of virtual private networks and other tools that bypass the country's Great Firewall. The move allows China's censors to extend their control beyond the limits of the firewall. Your free access to VOA Asia, Facebook is anytime. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, new research published this week in the journal Brain suggests that the lack of quality sleep could raise your chances of contracting Alzheimer's disease. And the Centers for Disease Control reports that more than 30% of Americans don't get enough sleep. VOA's Kevin Innix reports that the problem is creating a whole new tech market, promising ways to get some sleep.
This is the Dream headband, just one new product that says it can help you get a good night's sleep.
The whole concept of the product is based on the measurement of the brain activity and acting on the brain activity by using sounds.
And the handy app keeps track of how much good sleep you're getting.
Using sounds and doing like rhythmic stimulation, we can basically modulate the rhythm of the brain in order to get more deep sleep.
These types of products are also hitting the baby market.
It looks at heart rate, temperature, and motion to try to determine if the baby is healthy, how well they're sleeping, and it will alert the parents if there's something wrong.
It seems that if you're in the business of getting a good night's sleep, business is good.
Sleep devices and sleep technologies are doing great. They're becoming increasingly popular in recent years, and I think what's driving the market is that people are becoming more aware of their health.
But doctors who are working to deal with sleep disorders say they are not convinced about the usefulness or reliability of all these gadgets.
They should be cautious about not relying on them to, you know, help them with solving a sleep problem or even determining how much sleep that they've had each night.
But Kushida is grateful that people realize that sleep is more than just 8 hours of lost productivity.
I view it as a good thing just because it increases general awareness about sleep and the potential for sleep disorders.
Smart beds, smart pillows, baby monitors, or sleep apps may help. But researchers consistently say one of the most important ways to sleep well is to unplug and put down the phone. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Often linked with sleep disorders are eating disorders, but now a new film premiering on the streaming service Netflix, To the Bone, takes a poignant and sometimes humorous look at the issue of eating disorders. As VOA Asia's David Byrd tells us, the film reflects some of the real-life struggles of its director and one of its stars.
Lily Collins plays Ellen, or Ellie, as she prefers to be called. Ellie comes from a Los Angeles family where her father is never home, her stepmother is distant, and her real mother is a lesbian with a bipolar disorder who moves to Arizona to be with her girlfriend. Ellie has an eating disorder but gets kicked out of her fourth ED rehab. She finally agrees to an unconventional inpatient facility run by Dr. Beckham, played by Keanu Reeves. It's there that Ellie meets Luke, a British dancer whose career was cut short by an injury and who is the lone male patient in her unit.
Cigarette for dinner. That's not going to get you points.
Not in the mood.
Okay.
And who in hell made you house dead mother? You walk around here like you've got it all figured out. Well, if you're so fixed and special, why don't you go back to New Jersey or London or wherever the fuck you're from?
I am going back, as soon as my BMI is closer to my age. But right now, I'd rather try and help people than mope about feeling sorry for myself.
You have no idea how I'm feeling.
To the Bone is based in part on director Marty Noxon's own 10-year struggle with eating disorders. Lily Collins, who also struggled with an eating disorder earlier in her life, says that the film was never intended to glamorize anorexia, but to give it an honest treatment.
Nor Marty or I, having gone through the disorder ourselves, nor anyone else in the cast and crew would ever actively pursue making a film that glamorized, fetishized, or encouraged a disease that is so negative. So those were our intentions.
Alex Sharp, who plays Luke, and Collins both told the Associated Press the film deals with a serious subject, but it's not intended to be morose.
It is a dark, it's serious topic. I think serious is a better word than dark, but it's also got a lot of humor to it. So I think we're trying to hone in on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually amazing that we're even having a conversation about it.
Totally.
That's the important thing, is that we're sitting here discussing a subject matter that people have steered clear of for a long time.
To the Bone has generated some controversy, with some critics and social media users voicing concerns that the film glamorizes eating disorders. Lily Collins denies that criticism and says that all art pushes some boundaries, including this film.
If you're putting something out into the world for yourself, for a positive reason, for the right intentions, then that's all you can do, and people are going to take from it what they will. And hopefully people take away from this film that, you know, asking for help is never a weakness, and it's a strength, and that you're never alone in your struggles.
Alex Sharp agrees that artists have faced controversy in the past, but that's not an excuse for avoiding controversial subjects like eating disorders.
The history of starting a new conversation on something that's important always causes waves.
The film streams on Netflix beginning July 14th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And whether you're watching Netflix or listening to audio, we're glad that you've stopped by and listened to us for a little while, VOA Asia. And if you happen to be in the Philippines, and Diliman specifically, you can catch us on DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines. We thank everyone who's listening there. Our director is Tracy Carter and engineer Carl Starling. They also get our big thanks, along with managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Byrd. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.